We'll hear argument now number 00347, the Wharf Holdings Limited et al. Versus United International Holdings. Mr. Dodig.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, let me start by suggesting that whether my client Wharf Holdings misrepresented its intention to sell stock of Wharf Cable to UIH is a matter of no concern under the 34 Act. The paradigm, Section 10B plaintiff, is an investor who has purchased a security which has been inflated by deception, the price of which has been inflated by deception or manipulation. And I submit that the central purpose of the 34 Act is to protect such investors from financial loss. The 34 Act, I submit, was not passed to provide a federal remedy to plaintiffs who complain of their inability to purchase stock. The 34 Act was not passed for the purpose of federalizing the adjudication of disputes over the ownership of securities.
It depends on what you consider the security to be in this case.
In part, that is true, Your Honor, but I think not solely. Not solely. I think there are also issues going to the nature of the misrepresentation involved. And the first...
Talk first about what the security is.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what the respondents say and what the court below believed is that the security here was an option. And the definition of security in the Act includes an option.
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor. But what I am suggesting to Your Honor is that the oral expression which passes or is asserted to be a security in this case should not be accepted as such. That in this case, that what you're basically dealing with is a conversation which gave rise to an asserted right to purchase common stock in a subsidiary. The answer to why, as I understand the law, Your Honor, is rooted in the blue chip stamps case. And as I interpret that case, Your Honor, I believe it to reflect a reluctance on the part of the court to accept oral assertions as satisfying the predicate to establish standing to sue as a purchaser of securities.
Mr. Dodig, how far do you take that? Are you saying that no oral representations count under the Exchange Act?
Well,
are you saying that that goes for the SEC as well as what we have here, private suitor?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I'm not saying that an oral statement cannot constitute a misrepresentation. Far be it from me to suggest that. Going to the second part of your question, Your Honor, I certainly think the distinctions can be made between the breadth of Section 10B in the hands of the SEC and the breadth of the judicially implied private right of action under Section 10B. And as Your Honor is aware, there are distinctions. In an SEC action, it is of no concern whether anyone relied on the misrepresentation. In fact, there is no purchaser requirement constraining the SEC's enforcement power. So I think the contours of the private right of action, which is implied under Section 10B, are quite different from the contours within which the SEC might bring an enforcement action.
So you
would
say
you say, Mr. Dodig, that there can't be any oral options as a matter of federal securities law?
Your Honor, I think as a matter of federal securities law, as I read the blue chip stamps case, that a conversation which a person asserts to be an oral option should not, under the doctrine of that case, be accepted as a security.
Well, that would certainly take it beyond the holding of the case.
There is no question about that. I mean, the holding of the case itself was limited to a situation in which the offerees in that situation did not purchase the stock. But what I say to Your Honor is I don't think, given what I understand to be, and of course Your Honor would know better than I, the thrust of that opinion, the reluctance of the court to accept wholly oral testimony, not for the purpose of saying whether or not there has been a misrepresentation, but for the purpose of satisfying the threshold predicate requirement of whether or not the plaintiff has purchased securities, the court, time and again in the course of that opinion, said that the principal advantage of that doctrine was to place as a requirement for standing in a 10B case a transaction which could be proven by document.
But that isn't the issue here, whether the plaintiff purchased or not. The issue here is whether the security existed, whether there was indeed an option or there wasn't an option. If there was an option, there's no doubt that this plaintiff purchased it. It isn't a question of whether the plaintiff, you know, agreed to accept the option or not. As I understand it, not an issue. The question is, was there an option?
Well, I'm not sure that Your Honor is correct in saying that there's no question as to whether or not there was the purchase of an option here in any contractually binding sense. Because, as Your Honor is aware, it certainly is our position that the court, the district court, failed to properly instruct the jury with respect to the statute of frauds.
But it's quite a different question in Blue Chip. The question in Blue Chip is whether the plaintiff would have bought the stock or not. You have no idea whether the plaintiff would have bought the stock. Plaintiff said, I would have, but for this misrepresentation, or I would have sold it, but for the misrepresentation. It's totally up in the air. The question here is much simpler, much more focused. Was there a promise by the alleged seller of the option to deliver the stock or not?
I don't think it's simpler, Your Honor, in the sense in which Blue Chip Stamp saw a difficulty. And if I could explain.
Okay.
It's not simpler for the following reason. The core, as I understand it, the Blue Chip Stamp's concern was that you'll get someone who attempts to establish standing to bring a Section 10B action based on an oral assertion of what it is they would have done. Now, I submit to Your Honor that this case is no different in that respect. The oral option, the purchase of the oral option, all of that is a lawyer's description of what happened in a conversation. And just as in —
It's not a description of woulda, coulda, shoulda. I mean, and that's what was at issue in Blue Chip. Oh, you know, had I known this, I would have. And had I not known it, I would not have. And it's all speculation about the future. There's no speculation about the future here. It is a simple past fact. Was there this promise to deliver the stock in exchange for certain actions by the other side, or was there not? That's not — at all as hard to prove as the woulda, coulda, shoulda stuff is.
I think it is, if I may. I think this is a woulda, coulda, shoulda case, no question about it. Don't forget that in the Blue Chip Stamps case, you weren't talking about a drive-by offeree in the marketplace. What you were talking about in Blue Chip Stamps were a group of retailers who, as a result of a plan of reorganization that was entered after a consent decree, had the right to purchase a determinate number of shares, which was defined in the consent decree. Therefore, their right to make the purchase was clearly documented. In addition, in terms of the damage claim in that action, in terms of the injury, they were pointing to the difference between what the price the stock was trading at currently and the price which it was offered at in the prospectus, and they said, that is the measure of my damages. Here, you're dealing with, I think, very much a weaker case in the sense that the alleged act of purchase, the existence of the option, was throughout a lawyer's description of an oral event. And the woulda, coulda, shoulda goes like this. I woulda exercised my option. I would, over a period of years, have invested $50 million in this business. The business would have succeeded, and the stock market would have valued my stock interest at X million dollars.
Well, it seems to me in your last point, you've raised two points. One is a valuation point, which I don't think is directly what Justice Scalia is concerned with. The other, the woulda, shoulda point, is I would have exercised my option. But as I understand it, it's not open to us to assume that that is the case. As I understand it, the finding was that they did exercise the option, that they exercised the option by going ahead, in effect, and paying part of the consideration for that, for getting the option, which was the help that they gave to your client in getting the license. So that, as I understand it, we have a finding that this is not a hypothetical should-have or would-have case, but a case in which we went ahead, and when we did the part performance at least, that sealed the deal for the option. We had the option, and there is no question, as I understand it, that they sought to exercise the option at a later time. So I don't see where the subjunctive gets into this.
Well, I think where the subjunctive gets in, and perhaps it's not a subjunctive as such, what I'm saying to you is that the nature of the jury's conclusion in this particular case, I think, should not be relevant to the determination which the court is making. If my construction of the blue chip stamps case is accurate.
Well, I thought your construction is that, yes, blue chip stamps, as Justice Scalia put it, is a woulda, shoulda case, and this is a woulda, shoulda case, and I don't think this is.
No, it's not. I'm saying it's a woulda, shoulda case in many regards, Your Honor, in many regards. But what I'm saying with respect to the reason why blue chip stamps should be applied to the facts of this case is that I don't see any difference in the quality of the oral evidence or the oral event which gave rise to the finding and the quality of the oral evidence which drove the court in blue chip stamps to say, no, I'm not going to extend the doctrine to that situation.
Then I think you, in essence, are saying that there cannot be the oral creation of a security within the meaning of the Act.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm not saying that oral representations cannot be fraudulent. What I'm saying is where a plaintiff cannot satisfy the threshold requirement of purchase of a security except by a purely oral event, then I would say
it was. It lists a whole bunch of things that constitute a security. One of them is an option. It doesn't say anything about in writing in the text of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, as to that, I would suggest that if you look at Section 3A.10, that all of the elements of a security there, as defined, are elements which are ordinarily written instruments, common stock, bonds, notes. There is nothing, I think, Your Honor, in 3A.10, no one of the individual elements which is not a written document.
Do you think that Blue Chip would have come out differently if there were a writing from the president of the purchaser to his mother saying, we intend to purchase the stock of this corporation next week? Do you really think that the only problem in Blue Chip was the lack of a writing, or was it not?
No, I don't think
difficulty of showing what somebody would have done when it has not, in fact, been done. Whereas the claim here is that something has been done, not that it would have been done, but that it has been.
I'm not saying that I can't tell you what element alone would have sufficed for the conclusion.
You think a letter might have done the job?
I don't think it would have.
I don't think it would have either.
I think it has very little
to do with the writing and much more to do with the inherent ineffability of future intentions.
Well, that is certainly true.
And if that is true, then you have to admit that Blue Chip doesn't stand for the proposition that you can't have an orally created security, and that we are, as Justice Scalia started out by saying, going to have to go beyond Blue Chip to hold your way here.
Well, I'm not suggesting that the Blue Chip stamps opinion governs the facts of this case. What I would point out to Your Honor is that two circuit courts have interpreted Blue Chip stamps to bar standing to a plaintiff who sought to satisfy the purchase requirement and sought to assert standing on the basis of an oral agreement to purchase securities.
Why?
The Kagan case,
yeah.
Okay, in the Seventh Circuit, and the Pelletier case in the Eleventh Circuit, both held that. And those are, to my understanding, the only reasoned interpretations of blue chip stamps since that case was decided with respect to this particular issue.
Let me ask you this question. You're in effect saying that the 34 Act should be construed as, in effect, incorporating the statute of frauds for purposes of determining how a security or what can qualify as a security within the meaning of the Act. My question is, why should we interpret it when the statute of frauds has traditionally had an independent life of its own? And, of course, incidentally, in this case, the statute of frauds has either been satisfied by part performance or has been satisfied by part performance, as I understand it, in the findings of the jury.
Well, Your Honor, I would say a couple of things about that. First of all, certainly the courts of appeal have construed blue chip stamps to hold that if you had an purely oral event to satisfy the purchase requirement, which is unenforceable under the statute of frauds, that under blue chip stamps that didn't suffice, number one. Number two, the argument I was making about blue chip stamps and the significance of oral evidence is not limited to the statute of frauds. After all, you're talking about the meaning of a federal statute. And my interpretation of Justice Rehnquist's opinion in blue chip stamps, excuse me, the court's opinion in blue chip stamps, as underlying the Kagan and Pelletier decisions, is that where the quality of the satisfaction of the purchase is oral, where the quality of the evidence is purely oral, that the claim is too dubious in its nature to satisfy that threshold requirement.
So you're saying there could be an oral contract and there could be the oral creation of a security, but that the act of exercise cannot be oral.
No, I'm not saying that.
I thought that's what you just said. I'm sorry.
No, what I was saying is that we're, for purposes of construing the federal statute, irrespective of the statute of fraud, that the rule is a federal rule, and the rule should be that where the event which is said to satisfy the purchase of a security requirement is wholly oral, that that should be insufficient for very much the same reasons as the underlay the blue chip stamps requirement. Now, with respect,
Mr. Dodick, may I ask, there's an aspect of this case that's very disturbing to me, and I want you to get to it before your time runs out.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a case where, with one federal claim, I think there were 10 or 11 state claims. It was thoroughly tried. There were determinations of those state claims. The damages, as I understand them, would have been the same if you never had 10B in the picture. And at this stage, at least going in, I mean, you're urging that the court hold something today that has never held before. There is an arguable question of the interpretation of federal law. The state claims were pended to that and thoroughly tried. This is not a case that was dismissed at the threshold. Why are we... Seems to me that we're talking about something that is academic in this case if the judgment is going to stand based on the adjudication of the state claims.
Well, let me speak to that, if I may, and it also comes back to the second part of Justice Souter's question. And this has to do with the significance of the statute of frauds in this case. And the proposition which I'm going to advance, Justice Ginsburg, is that the errors committed by the district court and by the 11th Circuit with respect to the statute of frauds are clear and undeniable and are fatal to every cause of action which was asserted in this case, state or federal. Now, grant me the indulgence of assuming, although I've had little indication of this, that the Kagan and Pelletier approach would prevail, and that the court was at least open to the argument that, well, blue chip stamps means that if you have an oral event upon which you're basing your purchase argument and you don't have an enforceable contract under the statute of frauds, you don't have a purchase. Now, I think, and I don't mean to be rude or overreaching, but I think it's clear that both the district court and the 11th Circuit committed undeniable errors in the way they treated the statute of frauds question. In the Court of Appeals, they said that the statute of frauds did not apply to this case because the oral option, although a security for Securities Act purposes, was not a security for the purpose of the statute of frauds. Now, bear in mind that what we're talking about here is an oral agreement, contract, option for the sale of securities. And I submit that there can't be any question that the proper analysis on these facts is that the oral option was the contract for the sale of securities, which the statute of frauds rendered unenforceable.
Then, then one might say, if we accepted everything you said, that the federal claim would fail on a 12b-6. But there was federal question jurisdiction by virtue of a claim, of an arguable claim. And there was indeed a trial. And I just don't understand why, even if I accepted what you just said, that touches the fact that there was federal question jurisdiction, that what everything that you're talking about would go to, has there been a claim for relief stated?
Well, Your Honor, if I understand where we're at this point, and that is, what should be the consequence of a decision in this case that there was no Section 10b violation because of the existence of the state claim? And if I can address that question briefly, my position on that question is that if you take a look at the decided case authority since Santa Fe and Blue Chip Stamps, there are two lines of authority which unanimously would have resulted in the dismissal of these claims. Now, we've been talking about one of those lines, and that is to say whether or not you can create a purchase out of an oral event. There is another line of cases which doesn't deal with the purchase question. Another line of cases which says that where you have a misrepresentation of a party's intention to sell securities, as distinguished in the language of the courts from a misrepresentation going to the value of the securities, you don't have a Section 10b violation. There are four circuit courts that have come to that conclusion. There are two district court cases within the last 3 years that have followed those cases. Just this year.
What's the reasoning, Mr. Doddick? So there, you know, some English chancellor hundreds of years ago said that the state of a man's mind is as much a question of fact as the state of his digestion.
Yes, indeed, and that made it all the way into the restatement.
Good.
Did it not? Did it not? But what I say to you is this, and it's not a simple thought to get across, but to the extent we're talking about whether or not that type of statement which has been made in this case is actionable, that we've gone a long way beyond the state of the digestion, and where we have gotten to in the United States, generally speaking, is to the economic loss doctrine, which is squarely applicable to the facts of this case. And I think it's also, Your Honor, a doctrine which this Court should take into account in deciding what types of misrepresentation are actionable under Section 10b. The proposition is
even giving you the point that the only kind of misrepresentation that counts under 10b is a misrepresentation of value, do you really think that an option to purchase from someone who, when he gives you the option, has no intention of ever selling you what he has promised to sell you, is worth as much as an option from someone who, when he gives you the option, intends to go through with the delivery of the stock if you exercise it?
Your Honor,
doesn't that — I can't imagine what would more go to the value of the option the intent of the optionor to follow through on the contract or not.
Your Honor, I think whether or not you recognize the distinction here depends on how you characterize the purpose of the Securities Act if we're talking about a 10b-5 case, which is what we're talking about. And what I mean to say by that is there are lots of actions which can undermine the value of a security or an option to purchase a security. But I submit that there is a very clear distinction between a misrepresentation about the financial condition of a company and the refusal to accede to an asserted contractual obligation to deliver securities. And I suggest to your honors that given the way in which this court has articulated the purpose of the 34 Act, that a line should be drawn between those representations which in the garden variety section 10b-5 case speak to the value of a security and a situation such as this in which a person says, he should have sold me the stock and he didn't and he lied about it in the first place.
Mr. Dolig, you still haven't gotten to why, even if we accept what you said, there should be any redoing of this case when the state claims were tried and the same damages would apply to those.
I keep trying to get there, but I get diverted. And the reason is this, and this is the reason that I was speaking to the other reason why you shouldn't find a Section 10b violation here, which is in terms of the character of the representation which has been made here and the limited purpose of the 34 Act. And I was about to get to that point when I said there are four circuit courts who've decided uniformly, consistently, that the 34 Act does not apply to an alleged misrepresentation of a party's intention to sell securities.
Third circuit, but fourth circuit, the question,
seventh circuit. I'm about there. And the answer is that is the kind of decision which can be made in a Rule 12 case. Now, I understand your honors formulation of, well, if they've got jurisdiction and there's a decision, what is this all about? Well, what I'm saying to you is this. There is a great deal of difficulty with a standard which says whether or not the court should proceed to adjudicate the state law claims depends on the degree of frivolity of the federal action. I say to you that those courts, those circuit courts, which have decided that if you have a case which is dismissible under Rule 12, then you shouldn't go forward and adjudicate the state claims, is squarely applicable here.
The question is whether or not we're not in the posture of should you go forward. They have gone forward. And what you're saying is that we should upset this entire adjudication. If we were back in the beginning and the question was should the federal court go forward on the state claims once the federal claim is out of the picture, one gets one answer. But we're at the end of the line and these cases have in fact been tried.
Well, I say that factor is not worth consideration, which your honors, according to it, for the following reason. Number one, there is a value in having important, unsettled questions of state law decided by state courts. And that is why the courts have been restricted from asserting jurisdiction over the state claim when they have dismissed the federal claim prior to the trial. Now, I say that if you accept my construction of Section 10b, if you accept my construction of blue chip stamps, as six circuit courts have done, the answer is when that case came up on a Rule 12 motion, Judge Kane should have thrown it out. Now, he should not have gone forward at that point to have adjudicated the state cause of actions. And I say to you that...
And that is a matter of lack of jurisdiction, but abuse of discretion.
That's correct. Abuse of discretion. Because had he made the right decision, assuming, granting me the assumption, that there is no 10b-5 action here, he should have thrown the case out at that point. Now you have to ask yourself, well, does it make a difference that we have had some investment of time as a result of a judicial mistake? And again, a couple of circuits have said, no, it doesn't make any difference because there are values in restraining the federal judiciary from deciding state court issues in those circumstances, which are not excused by the fact that someone made a mistake at the district court level, and we should therefore vacate that decision. That's what happened in Tully v. Mott Supermarkets, for example. Now, I say to you also...
We would not reach that judgment if we thought that the case for the federal claim was a lot more solid than you suggest, even if you would ultimately win on it, that this was not frivolous by any means.
That is true, but for one other consideration, Your Honor, and that's this. I say to you that the Tenth Circuit and the District Court were unquestionably wrong in the way they decided the statute of frauds question and in the way they decided the economic loss doctrine question. A proper decision on either one of those theories would have thrown out every cause of action in this case, and I suggest to you that where you're in a situation where there is, in fact, at the end of the day, no federal question, and you're presented with a...
Thank you, Mr. Dodick. Mr. Cohen, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. UIH pleaded, and the jury found, that UIH purchased a security, an option, and paid for that separate security with services that Wharf requested and crucially needed.
I have one question. Justice Souter asked the counsel petitioner whether or not the option was not exercised when these additional services were performed. I take it after October 8, 1992.
Thank you.
I thought there was some agreement from petitioner's counsel that was, in fact, the theory of the case. Of course, he says there's no option at all. When was this option
exercised?
There
was both a purchase and a separate attempt to exercise.
When was it exercised in here?
In the spring of 1993, after Wharf got the cable franchise from the broadcast authority.
Okay, so the
Wharf
option
had, Wharf had conducted a public offering, raised the money, called Mr. Ng, and sought to exercise the option.
So the option was not exercised, in your view, immediately after October 8th when the additional services were performed?
It could not be. Its terms were that UIH would have the option, and it bought the option in return for these massive services. It would have the option to invest 10% of the capital required by this newly formed company and get 10% of the stock. That option would be exercisable. This is all in our complaint, would be exercisable for 6 months after the award of the franchise to Wharf Cable by the broadcast authority, because without that award, there would be nothing.
Mr. Cohen, I must say I just marvel at the bonhomie or old-fashioned nature of your client to gamble all of this money on an oral handshake deal. Do people still do that out there?
They do.
I mean, how much money was involved in this deal?
Well, the cost of providing the services with which we purchased the option was about $1 million out of pocket, but it was the time of people who were investors in these businesses.
Well, I wouldn't even buy an automobile without a written contract.
Well, there was a good deal of testimony at
trial.
I'm
not sure that we ought to protect this kind of recklessness. If you want to rely on a handshake deal, then you better be sure you're shaking the hand of somebody who can be trusted.
It was a handshake deal that had been preceded by a written reference to an option in the bid that Wharf submitted to the broadcast authority. That language was pulled at the last minute. It's an option that is referenced in later internal Wharf documents.
We have over a million lawyers in this country, and one of the main things they do is to make sure that people, make things easy by putting it in writing.
And UIH would have been well advised to come out of that meeting, call its lawyer, say, how do we document this? But the agreement at that meeting was that documentation would be prepared. The agreement at that meeting also was that Wharf needed.
You went ahead before the documentation was.
Yes.
And I'm making a serious point here. I'm just not saying your client is foolish. I'm questioning whether we ought to protect foolish people like that, whether we ought to enable strike suits, enable people to be accused of having sold an option. in order to protect somebody who's foolish enough to invest $1 million on the basis of a handshake.
The kind of person you're talking about is a person who is a victim of an unscrupulous securities salesman who calls up and says, I've got an oil company here, and I've got some shares to sell you, and fails to say there isn't any oil, and says, give me your credit card number or send me a check and I'll send you a certificate.
But unlike those typical securities situations, what worries me about this case is the pizza man says, Smith, my customer, told me over the phone that if I got the pizza there on time, he'd give me 50 shares of his stock. Do we have a securities fraud?
You have a fraud if there
is...
Pizza
man calls up. Pizza man. I called him yesterday, and he said if I got the pizza there in 15 minutes, he would sell me 50 shares of his stock for $40. Is that a securities fraud?
I think yes.
Yes?
I think there is a contract. I don't think I need that one. I think my case is much easier.
You're saying then any time a person claims that somebody sold him a share of stock or promised to sell him a share of stock orally, that becomes a federal securities case. I didn't think you were going to say that, but if you are, I'm quite interested.
Anytime someone has a provable, enforceable contract to buy a share of stock.
We're saying the same thing, and
yes.
I guess the argument against that would be that the securities statute doesn't intend to have every oral contract for selling some stock to become a securities fraud case. There was no intention to have that done. There's no reason to have it done. It's perhaps a contract action, and most states wouldn't permit it because it would be oral.
Justice Breyer, what we have here is not merely an executory contract to purchase some stock. We have a completed, consummated contract to sell and purchase an option, which is a separate security.
I know, but I'm trying to get at the policy that would underlie my concession exactly right. The pizza man says, I have a completed executory contract to sell me an option in return for my getting the pizza there on time.
He has promised
to sell me 50 shares of stock.
That's an option. He hasn't been defrauded out of anything except perhaps driving fast to deliver the pizza. We have been defrauded out of the services, the valuable services that we undertook to deliver only because Wharf agreed to grant us an option. That option is a separate security which we were then...
You're missing my question, and I won't pursue it except to add what I thought you'd answer. I thought you'd answer my question, no, because there's no fraud there. And then I was about to say... But all you have to do is add the allegation. And at the time, he intended not to carry it out. And that allegation always can be added. For after all, he's defending the case, isn't he? And if he's defending the case, that's pretty good evidence that he intended not to carry it out. And therefore, you've made all or almost all oral promises into securities cases, contrary to the intent of the statute. Now, I was trying to get you to address the policies that might refute my hypothetical, but maybe it's too complex and maybe you can't do that easily.
Well, let me say this about the policy. First, there is the difference between a mere breach of contract and an intent at the time that a contract is entered into not to perform, and several courts of appeals have spoken to that. Second, we are talking here about the defendant's intention, quite different from the problem in Blue Chip of the plaintiff proving the plaintiff's own intention by his own affidavit, an inherently untestable thing that gets him to the jury. To get past the defendant's intention, statement that he intended to fulfill the contract, The plaintiff is going to have to come up with some concrete evidence. We had that evidence here, written evidence from Wharf's files that Wharf did not intend at the time that it entered into the contract to fulfill it. And furthermore, Congress has taken much of this burden off the court's shoulders, if you'll excuse me for just a second, by adding the requirement in the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, in which it recognized the 10b-5 claim and decided how to cabinet, and it requires a specific pleading of facts sufficient to create a, quote, strong inference of intent to defraud. And if you can't do that, your claim is dismissed under that statute.
Good. Okay.
So that policy has been addressed.
Somewhere in that long sentence, you made the point that in Blue Chip there was no solid written evidence, as you say there is in your case. Do you think Blue Chip would have come out differently if there was solid written evidence?
Blue Chip.
To demonstrate that the alleged purchaser would have purchased?
No. Blue Chip was interpreting the statute.
Right. So what
the statute requires
a purchaser. What difference does it make that you have written evidence and Blue Chip didn't?
I don't.
If Blue Chip wouldn't have come out any differently, written evidence or not, what difference does it make?
The difference is that we have a completed purchase. We have a completed purchase that is
sustained by testimony. The evidence or the existence of written evidence or not makes no difference.
Let me say one other thing about Blue Chip.
Yes or no, the existence of written evidence or not in this case makes no difference.
I think it makes no difference to the outcome.
Mr. Cohen, I think.
What if this contract were found to be void because it didn't comply with the Colorado statute of frauds? Could it nonetheless be acted upon? In other words, would that be a final death knell for your suit, or can you say that under federal securities law that isn't conclusive?
Well, first, of course, it was valid under the, under the Colorado statute of frauds.
Could you get to the answer?
I don't think it would be a death knell. I'm trying to answer the question.
Then even though it were invalid under the Colorado statute of frauds, it could proceed under the Federal Securities Act?
I think the sale of a security that is an invalid security but is represented to be a security is sufficient under Blue Chip to support a 10b-5 claim, whether the security is enforceable or not, and I think the majority of the courts of appeals have agreed with that.
You win. This is just what's worrying me. Imagine every state says sales of goods or services over $10 million has to be in writing. All right? Now, to a person who's — that would make no difference. It would be that statement I just made would be, as a practical matter, irrelevant, because anybody in the stock area — because anybody who wanted to allege an oral contract to sell $10 million worth of stock would run right into federal court, say it's a securities claim.
He has to have a security. He has to have.
No, what he says is he promised to sell me some stock. The promise is an option, on your view, and therefore it is a security.
That promise is not an option on my view. An option is a security that you pay separate consideration for that gives you the right but not the obligation to purchase another security.
Oh, I'm promised.
That's
sorry.
What we have.
I'm sorry. In return for my services, he promised that he would sell me some stock.
Yes.
All right. All those cases which would be outlawed by the state statute of frauds I've imagined would suddenly come into federal court as securities claims. It's the same problem I have. What's bothering me is the sweep of a decision in your favor. And that's what I want.
And what I've tried to say is that you can decide this case in my favor without reaching that by agreeing with the Court of Appeals that what you had here was a completed, actual, paid-for sale of a different security, an option, which the parties intended to document but didn't end up documenting because that was part of the fraud.
Why isn't that sale worth $1 million or whatever the statute of frauds limit is?
The statute of
frauds. Surely that contract is worth something, and what was the value of that?
It was, and we paid for it in services that had a cost to us of about $1 million.
And is that below the state statute of frauds amount, $1 million?
Justice Scalia, first of all, the present statute in Colorado and every other state says sales of securities are enforceable without a writing. There is no statute of frauds applicable to securities.
That's the answer, then.
And at the time, there was a statute of frauds which was determined not to apply because because of UIH's completed performance of its obligations.
Mr. Cohen, I just want to go back to Justice Breyer's question. And
performance took this out of the statute of frauds. Excuse me.
Tell me if I'm wrong here. I think we've got to say something about the definite about what the statute of frauds rule is that will underlie our case, even if you're right on part performance, and I will assume you are. Because we could construe the statute either to say there is no requirement of writing in the statute. In other words, it has no built-in statute of frauds. Or we could say there is some kind of a built-in statute of frauds, but it's satisfied by part performance. Or we could say, possibly, I don't know whether we should, but we could say the federal statute, in effect, simply leaves the problem of writing to state law. If state law would, in fact, recognize the contract under its statute of frauds, then that contract is sufficient to create a security or whatnot for purposes of the Securities Act. I think we've got to say one of those three things. Which should we say?
I think you should say that the question whether there has been a sale of securities is a question of state law, as it has been. And
the question of whether there is a creation of a security in the case of the creation of the option, that too, I mean, that's essentially a contractual act, and that too is a question to be governed by the state statute of fraud.
Yes, I think whether the resulting contract fits the definition of a security is, of course, a question of federal.
Right. Mr. Cohen, the federal court determined what the state statute of frauds was in this case, and the federal court determined that performance took this out of the statute?
Yes, as a matter of
what if I disagree with
matter of state
I mean,
law.
It seems to me performance takes a contract out of the statute where you have a bilateral contract. I promise to do one thing, you promise to do another, one of us performs. The contract is then out of the statute of frauds. But when you have something that is called a unilateral contract, if you do something, you don't have to, but if you do something, then I am obligated to do something else. And that's what you have here.
No.
If you did these things, I will give you an option.
No.
You did the things, you got the option. That is what concluded the contract. And I would not hold that, if I were the state Supreme Court judge, that statute was out of the state statute of frauds.
What we had was not a unilateral contract. It was a bilateral contract, as the jury found. Wharf sold us an option on October 8, 1992.
To go out and do those acts which created the option for you?
Yes,
did
we were.
Did you promise to do those acts?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did, and
well,
we did them.
Well,
but we
that
promised
contract
to do
was within the statute of frauds then,
because there
certainly wasn't any performance of that.
Yes, there was. There was a performance of our contract to acquire an option by providing services that Wharf requested, which included dispatching named people immediately to Hong Kong at our expense to serve as officers of Wharf. Of Wharf Cable.
You could have been sued if you didn't do that?
We could have been sued if we hadn't done that.
That is not an option. That promise is not a security. If you promise to do some act, and I in exchange promise that if you do the act, I will give you an option, that contract is not an option and is not therefore a security.
It wasn't an if. They entered into a contract. This is the jury finding on a stipulated verdict form. They entered into a contract granting UIH an option. In that contract, granting us an option, we promised and immediately did pay for that option by providing required services. There was a completed actual sale here. That's what this trial was about for 11 weeks.
But it still turns on characterizing what was done here as going in never intending to perform. And the concern that Justice Breyer expresses, you could make that up. How do you distinguish between a garden variety breach of contract where somebody doesn't perform and one where from day one there was no intent to perform?
You need to prove that at day one there was no intent to perform. You need to get past some motion to dismiss to have concrete evidence of that. And there needs to be a completed contract, a completed sale in connection with which that misrepresentation is made.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Mr. Roberts, we'll hear from you.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, when the seller of a stock option misrepresents its intention to permit the buyer to exercise the option, the seller violates Section 10B. The text of Section 10B prohibits the use of any manipulative or deceptive device in connection with
the seller of an option?
The seller of the option, which here is Wharf Cable, sold the stock option, which was the right to purchase.
Not an agreement to be performed. You think the sale took place?
A sale took place at the meeting. There was a contract, and as was explained, it was the contract was an exchange of a promise to provide services for the sale of the option. The promise was performed.
You say what happened was that Wharf said, "I give you an option today, and in return, you must in the future perform certain services."
I sell you an option in exchange for your promise to perform services, and that there was performance, which would take that contract out of the statute of frauds.
And you think that the respondent here could have been sued for breach of contract if the respondent did not perform those services? I didn't read the transaction as really envisioning that.
Under the understanding that there was a sale for a promise, yes. Under the understanding that
that
sale
would follow,
for services.
You think that that was the reality, that the respondent could have been sued if it didn't send those people over to do the work that was. You see, I viewed it as much more a unilateral contract. If you send the people over, you'll have an option. But
I don't think it makes any difference, Your Honor.
It does for the statute of fraud purpose.
There was performance of the promise, which would take it out of the statute of frauds, even if it was a contract that was unilateral. The performance of the services would take it out of the statute of frauds as well. And once the option was purchased, the option was a security, and the misrepresentation of the intention to permit the exercise of the option was a misrepresentation.
Well, I think it is important, and you agree with the counsel for the respondent that this was a bilateral contract in which they could have been sued if they did not provide the necessary services, and those services were sufficiently specific to have a contract that was not illusory, and the trial courts and the jury so found. And
what the jury found was that they entered into a contract selling them an option to purchase 10% of the stock. I don't recall right at the moment. I don't have it in front of me, that finding. I'm not sure whether it said in exchange for the promise or not in the specific language of that finding. But it was the finding was on page E21.
I think the concern, Mr. Roberts, is that we not sweep in under the Securities Act a lot of breach of contract suits.
Yes, Your Honor, and you don't do that, because in order for there to be a 10b-5 violation, there must be a misrepresentation. There has to be a fraud, not just a breach of contract.
That was exactly
why I asked
my case. It seems like the simplest thing in the world. Look, this will come up in families. No brokers, no securities. Uncle Joe promised to give me his securities if I would take care of him for a year or two, which I did. Okay, we've got your option. And you say, oh, well, but what about the misrepresentation? Well, if Uncle Joe's a lie. Look, he's defending the case, isn't he? And therefore, if you believe that he made the oral statement, why didn't he carry it out? So he's here defending it. So he must have intended not to carry it out. Now, maybe that isn't totally sufficient, but you'd be well along the way.
It's not sufficient, Your Honor. Just as it's easy to allege, it's very hard to prove. In order to avoid dismissal under the Private Litigation Securities Reform Act, the plaintiff has to allege with particularity facts that give rise to a belief that there is misrepresentation.
He is here defending the case, which proves he never intended from day one to follow his oral thing, and besides, I remember his saying that once.
That would be insufficient to meet that burden, Your Honor. The fact that he's defending a suit obviously would be insufficient. And the plaintiff's own testimony about what he thought the defendant's intention was does not prove the state of the defendant's mind, nor does the fact that the defendant failed to perform prove anything more than a breach of contract. The restatement makes that clear. That same principle would apply. Failure to perform alone is not sufficient. There has to be additional evidence, and there was additional evidence in this case, both testimonial and documentary evidence, that there was no intention to perform at the time. In addition, it's important to understand that it's important to cover oral contracts such as these, because many contracts for the purchase of securities are oral. Such as when customers contract with their brokers over the telephone to buy stock. And oral contracts for the sale of securities are generally enforceable under the law of all 50 states. In addition to that, the Act does not require that there be a writing to make someone a purchaser or a seller of a security. The Act provides that options are securities, and the Act also provides that a purchase includes any contract to purchase.
Do you agree that the statute, in effect, looks to state law on the question of statute of frauds issues?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I think the statute of frauds is irrelevant to a violation of Section 10b. The statute of frauds is a...
So there's either a standard implied in the statute itself, or there is no... a requirement implied in the statute itself, or there is no requirement, period.
There is no requirement. Even under common law, the traditional rule is that fraud in inducing a contract is actionable, even if the contract is unenforceable under the statute of frauds. The same principle applies to Section 10b as well.
Whether or not something is a contract, does that depend on state law?
Contract is a federal term in the statute. It's a federal question, I think, whether it's a contract.
Is there a court authority for that?
There's court authority for the fact that purchasers, parties to an oral contract to purchase, are purchasers of securities.
But they say notwithstanding state law?
Notwithstanding state contract law,
not statute.
No, they don't specifically address notwithstanding state law, but in the Court of Appeals case that comes to mind, the Threadgill case from the D.C. Circuit, the district court had said that there was no purchase or sale because the contract had not been performed, fully performed, and the Court of Appeals reversed and said that the Act defines contract to include to include any contract to purchase.
Yeah, but that leaves open the question what a contract is, and don't we look to state law to determine what that contract is?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It wouldn't serve the purposes of the Securities Act for for
well, it would open the doors of the Security Act, presumably, to claims that state law would not recognize, and that in itself might be a good reason, if we knew nothing else, to say that the question of contractual formation is a state law question.
First, you don't have to address that issue here because there's a
well, but we may
sale.
Get very close to it if we have to address what the source of any writing requirement or the dispensation of any writing requirement is, and if we look to state law on that, presumably it would be odd if we didn't look to state law as well for what a contract is.
I don't think that you should look to state law for any of these questions, Your Honor. It's a question of
how old you have to be to buy a security? You mean we can adopt a federal rule that 16-year-olds can buy security?
If there's
surely
fraud,
it's a question of state law, isn't it?
Whether it's a sale under state law is a question of state law. Whether it's a sale for purposes of the Securities Act is a question of federal law. And it wouldn't serve the purposes of Section 10B to hold that because there isn't a sale, it's enforceable under state law.
But to say it wouldn't serve the purposes of Section 10B isn't the final answer in a case like this. Congress legislates with a background of what has been decided under state law and what's a matter of federal law.
Yes, Your Honor, Congress does, but Congress simply used the term contract in the definition of purchase to include any contract. It used the term contract, and that was commonly understood at the time, if I may finish.
No, you may not. Thank you,
Sorry.
Mr. Roberts.
Thank you.
Well, here are the cases submitted.